Welcome to the World War I History Podcast, produced by the MacArthur Memorial. We invite you to follow us on Twitter at MacArthur1880 or find the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial on Facebook. This podcast was sponsored by the Ernst and Gertrude Tico Charitable Foundation. When most people think of World War I on the Western Front, they probably think of trenches. Trench systems were present along most of the 475 miles from the English Channel to the Swiss Alps. It wasn't just one straight continuous line, however. The systems had many layers that supported the daily life and movement of millions of soldiers. If laid end to end, the trench systems would have stretched an estimated 35,000 miles. Trenches play a prominent role in most World War I movies. They're often depicted as sites of suffering, of terror, and even boredom. But what was day-to-day life really like in the trenches? And how do the movies get this right or wrong? To explore this topic, today we welcome historian and archaeologist Andrew Robertshaw back to the podcast. We've talked with him about World War I archaeology in the past, and he's also served as a film advisor on films such as the 2019 film 1917. So welcome, sir, and thank you for joining us yet again.
Thank you for the invitation.
So why don't you start us off with what is a trench and how do they evolve between 1914 and 1918 on the Western Front?
Well, the war begins as a war of movement. I mean, the German plan was to effectively invade via Belgium, capture Paris, and then turn east and fight the Russians, who were slow to mobilize, which sounds horribly familiar, doesn't it? That didn't work. They ran out of time. They should have captured Paris in 6 weeks. So to hold onto the ground they've captured and send some of their army to the east, they had to build defenses. And those defenses were trenches.
In most World War I movies, you see the trench and you see soldiers climbing out of it. Sometimes you see other areas. And in the introduction, I mentioned trench systems. What facilities or support areas were typically part of a trench system?
I think what you have to regard trenches as, it is not a crust. It's more like a sponge. So what you've actually got is a front line, a support line, a reserve line. They could stretch back tens of kilometers, to be perfectly honest. And they're all linked up by trenches that go forwards and backwards. Up trenches and down trenches called communication trenches, hence your figure indicating just how many miles of trenches there would have been. But you have to bear in mind that half the army was infantry, the other half were not, so there were gunners and engineers and drivers and that kind of thing, who never went in the trenches. And the guys in the trenches were not there full time. It was a relatively brief period in those trenches.
Were there differences between a British trench or a French trench and a German trench?
Look, the German trenches were bigger, they were deeper, they had more concrete. And that's not because they were richer or cleverer. It's purely because they could win the war by staying where they were. They were fighting a war in a foreign country or two foreign countries, Belgium and France. The only way the Allies, be they British, French, Belgium, American, is by advancing. So our trenches are somewhere that you are there temporarily before pushing the enemy back. The army in the Great War, our army, was known as the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, which sounds awfully like something Victorian. In the Second World War, it was the BLA, the British Liberation Army. So bear in mind that when we're advancing, be it Vimy, be it Montfaucon, be it Meuse Argonne, we are trying to liberate areas of occupied France. And I think that never really makes it to the screen, rarely makes it into history books.
Can you walk us through a typical day in the life of a soldier in the trenches on the Western Front?
If you're British, Canadian, Australian, you're probably there for 5 days. Okay, so let's assume that you arrive in your trench to relieve the outgoing soldiers on Sunday evening, okay? So you arrive around midnight, then you go into your nighttime routine. One man on guard duty, one man resting, one man working, 1 hour intervals all night, till around about half an hour before dawn, because that's when an attack is likely. Then you stand to, and stand to means every man armed on the parapet, the front of the trench, Tête in French, head, covers your head. Back of the trench, by the way, paradoxe covers your back. You are then there for about an hour in case the enemy attack, making advantage of half light. Then you go into, for British soldiers, rum ration, then breakfast. One man in 10 is now on guard duty. Inspection and all those things go on. You have your dinner, as we would call it, lunch. After lunch, one man in 10 is on guard duty, looking through a periscope. The others sleep in the afternoon. There's not much going on. Then you get round to your tea, your supper, you have that. Then it's going to get dark, so you stand to again in case the enemy attack. Then you go into your nighttime routine, which means, frankly, most soldiers are getting 4 or 5 hours sleep a day in daylight. They don't sleep at night. And that means at the end of 5 days, you are pretty useless, at which point you're relieved and you're probably not going to go back to your trench for 20 days. But you might actually be in the front line and then go back to the second line and then the third line as you get progressively more tired. The Germans, by the way, are rather different. They don't do it quite the same thing. They simply rotate through with their complete unit over a period of time. The French, bless them, they put a unit in the line and they leave it there till it's utterly exhausted, then they replace it. It's not the most efficient way of looking after men.
So let's talk about several movies, what they get right, what they get wrong. I'll read from a laundry list and you tell me what's right, what's wrong.
Yeah.
All Quiet on the Western Front from 1930.
A very good film made by people, many of whom were there. The German NCO in the film was a German NCO. The uniforms, I think, are largely the real things. The rifles are real. The book is written by somebody at the point when it's pretty inevitable there will be a Second World War, hence the stress on futility and the way that the movie ends. Clearly, it's about violence. Clearly, it's about particularly the weather. And everybody knows that in the Great War, according to movies at least, it rains every day. And if you're going to establish which war it's going to be, you would normally, be it Paths of Glory or any other movie, you're going to start with what was then known as a panning shot. Now it'd be done with a drone. You fly over no man's land. There are shell holes full of water. There's always a wagon wheel. There's always a dead horse. And eventually you dip down into a trench where men are waiting to go over the top. It's a pastiche of itself, but I was told on one occasion when working on a movie, War Horse, unless we show it that way, people wouldn't know what war it is. So it would appear that you're not allowed to have a dry day, and certainly you've got to have the obligatory wagon wheel and dead horse. I mean, that's the problem. That said, I would say All Quiet on the Western Front, the 1931, is very, very evocative of that experience. Written by somebody who was there, however, very briefly, I must say.
I think it's very interesting because, as we were talking before we actually started the podcast, World War II really seems to play a role in most of these World War I films. I mean, obviously, a lot of these films are being made right on the verge of either we're entering World War II or with World War II in hindsight. So, I mean, it completely changes the art form in terms of how we remember and identify World War I, to the point that you made, you have to show the dead horse and the wagon wheel and the trenches to let audiences know, oh, right, this is that first World War.
Yeah, and the point is that the war begins as the European War. Mm-hmm. It then, in Britain, it then becomes known as the Great War when the title is lifted. It's lifted by journalists, not by anybody else, from the Napoleonic Wars, that great 20-year-plus combat against revolutionary Napoleonic France. Then it becomes the war to end all wars. And the key thing for anybody looking at the history is it can only be World War I when you have World War II. Until then, it has to be the Great War. So unless you're looking ahead in some, I'm afraid to say, a very pessimistic way, and people were pessimistic about the future, then, you know, the Great War is what it actually is, because my granddad was there. He believed that it was the war to end all wars. And as we all know, that is not the case.
Next film, The Fighting 69th from 1940.
Again, you mentioned that the backdrop to this being another war. And in fact, clearly it's made at a time when war has begun in Europe. If anything, I think the film is made to show the 69th Regiment and how good they were, to show good soldiers and bad, although there is a redemption in all of that. But it's also done to say, look, you know, we've done this once. Do we need to do it again? So it has that basis in frankly, historically, what is isolation? You know, let's not do it again. We don't want to be drawn into this. You know, we did it last time. We saved the Allies' bacon. Why are we even contemplating it? So again, as I said previously, I'll mention again that MASH, when it was made, was really not about Korea. It was about Vietnam. But at the time, you couldn't commission a TV series about Vietnam during the Vietnam War. But if you look at it, you're going, there's a warning. There's a warning from history.
What do you think about in terms of like the set decoration and the equipment in that film?
Well, it most of it's done in studio. There isn't much idea of space. But to be honest, I don't know if you've noticed that actually the battle scenes in the TV series, I forgot what it's called now, about the Second World War. Help me here. I've forgotten his name of it now. The Spielberg series.
Band of Brothers.
Most of those battle scenes were done in studio, particularly the ones in the forest. They are very effective because what they are is they're very evocative of that sense of enclosure, which is what you get from trenches. But you have to bear in mind that a very limited amount of time was spent by soldiers in trenches, perhaps 5 days, 6 days in a month. And combat was very, very rare compared to Second World War, where it's more continuous. But the films want to always have battle after battle, men going over the top all the time. My grandfather was a soldier, a private soldier, for 1,000 days, roughly. 100 days, I've calculated, in the trenches. Combat experience, less than 4 days. Why? Because he was wounded twice and gassed twice. But that was it. You know, it's kind of, that's what the movie industry wants to represent. A trench is not somewhere you live. It's not somewhere you eat and you sleep and you drink and you, frankly, you know, go to the restroom. It's somewhere that you have combat in. And that is not realistic. But the reality is that trench warfare was, frankly, pretty boring.
All right. Next movie, Paths of Glory, 1957.
Paths of Glory, of course, is a Kubrick classic, brilliant film designed really to look at the way that the French army treated their soldiers at a time in 1917 when they were mutinying. And what it's really about is that sense of loss and futility. Again, the backdrop to that, I would say, is the increasing looming threat of the Cold War and nuclear war. So actually, it's saying that wars are unfair, they're unjust, and you know, we need to do everything we can to avoid it. So it's certainly not a celebration. It is in many ways realistic, but only really of combat. The veteran I spoke to many years ago told me that my war, I grew up in a rural area, my war boy, he said, was 90% bored stiff, 9% frozen stiff, 1% scared stiff. And I'm afraid to say, well, I'm afraid, I make money out of it, so I shouldn't be afraid, is what's presented on the screen is really 1% of the action rather than 99%. But no one would ever make a film about the reality of people sleeping in the afternoon or, I don't know, having a rum ration or making a cup of coffee, because that's just boring. You know, you don't do it.
War Horse, 2011.
Good film, written based on a novel by Michael Morpurgo. The novel is interesting, but in many ways unrealistic. Nobody who ever got a horse, if they were a private soldier, could bring it home. I don't think there was any evidence of horses being captured by the enemy and then coming back. But it did highlight the role of horses in a way that I couldn't give lectures and do the same thing. It does feature a very, very good actor who comes down the trench and blows a whistle and everyone goes over the top. That was me, by the way. That's why I thought the actor was brilliant.
That's
my
that.
One and only a Hollywood job. Mm-hmm. And I took direction from Steven Spielberg. But he said to me that morning, Andy, you'll enjoy this. And I said, no, I won't enjoy it. My granddad did it four times, for real. I'll do it because I know what it means. And that whistle that I blow was the last sound a lot of soldiers ever heard. Luckily for me, not my granddad. So it's kind of, you know, you'll enjoy it because it's about, well, no, it was extremely thought-provoking, I must say. The film itself did something that nothing else has done before, which is to raise the plight of horses. Somebody asked me to write a book called The Horse at War, and I said I couldn't because they weren't at war. They were in it, and I never wrote the book. There we are. And yet, there we are. We have, you know, what happens to horses in a war as large as that.
All right. 1917 from 2019.
Very controversial film. Argument is, why not send an aeroplane to drop a message to say, stop, don't attack? Well, you could do the same thing, actually, with Saving Private Ryan, because all you had to do was radio any unit that actually had a Private Ryan in it and get him to come back to the beach. The film lasts 10 minutes. You know, there's got to be jeopardy. But then what happened is that when we represented the German withdrawal to the Hindenburg Line, which they call the Seyfried Line, and we actually had them, at least in theory, withdrawing up to 20 miles, then people go, well, where are the shell holes? You know, where's the barbed wire? Well, they're not there because they've withdrawn into an area that actually was being cultivated, hence the cut down trees and the destroyed houses and everything else, and the cows in the film, or, by the way, which are all CGI, so don't worry about it. The key thing is, so was a rat, by the way. But the fact is, it was a way of showing an aspect of the war that we hadn't seen. But curiously, why not call it Passchendaele? Because that's where Sam Mendes, the director's grandfather, Alfred Mendes, got a medal for carrying a message. Well, the answer is, there already was a movie called Passchendaele. Nobody was going to fund a film called Passchendaele. It's already been done. Call it 1917. For most Brits, it doesn't mean very much. For most Americans, it would mean, hang on, it's about us, because we joined the war in 1917. So I suspect it caused quite a lot of disappointment and conflict, although it was a successful film, partly because it came out just before COVID broke out, so people could see it in the cinema. Oh, by the way, I'm not in that one.
Okay. Yeah, I'll admit I was a little confused by the title, because I think for military historians, 1917 means a lot of different significant things, you know, not just America's entrance into the war, but I mean, there's lot happening.
Well, it means Vimy, it means Passchendaele, mm-hmm. It means Messines, it means the Battle of Cambrai with the tanks, and it was none of those things. You know, it was the German withdrawal back to their basically constructed defences. And by the way, the reason that that's done is to shorten their lines because they're running out of men. And again, I don't think that really made it into the final script, the screenplay.
What did you think about the uniforms and equipment and stuff like that?
Well, they were very, very good, mainly because I worked with, I'm going to name check him, Dave Crossman. Dave Crossman was in charge of costume. He previously had been in charge of the military costume for 1917, so we had a rapport. And we were able to do all sorts to make it look as authentic as possible. And I'm very fortunate, actually, to have one of George Mackay's costumes now, which sits in my store, which I'm proud to get. But they were all supplied by a big costume house from Poland called Hero. And they are probably the best you're going to see in terms of costumes and how it was worn.
Do you ever get feedback from some of the actors about the equipment or the uniforms that are interesting?
Well, we had a boot camp for the two actors, particularly, and also for all the other extras, now calling supporting artists. So what we did there was to talk not only about what you're wearing, but why you're wearing it, how you're wearing it, what it means, and also about the motivation. And one of the things that I did for the actors in Warhorse was to talk to the German actors who were largely German to say what was their motivation. And I carried on with that because otherwise they end up just being ciphers for themselves because they're either nasty and mean or they're overweight and generous. And, you know, that's not really what it's about. It's actually saying, why would you as a German, you know, fight in this war? Well, A, you're a conscript, but B, you think you're defending the Reich. And that's true in, you know, World War One as well as World War Two. You know, so that's what I would kind of, one of my jobs is to do that.
All right. Last film, All Quiet on the Western Front, 2022.
I have to confess, I hate it. Why do I hate it? I hate it because it's only very loosely based on the book by Erich Remarque. It really plays fast and loose with history. There are lots of mistakes with it. It represents the German soldier as a victim of the war, and you could argue that everybody's a victim of the war because they're called into it. They don't want to be there, but it was the kind of the gratuitous use of flamethrowers by the French. The Flammenwerfer was, I'm afraid, invented and first used by the German army in 1915. The tanks being kind of not fair. Well, you know, have better technology and you'll make more than 20 tanks, which is the number that the German army actually managed to build in the war. And then the bigger attack at the end, that didn't happen at all by the Germans. The people that did attack just before 11 o'clock on the 11th day of the 11th month were Brits, but also Americans. And there was a big discussion also about Canadian soldiers being sent forward, you know, in the closing days of the war. You know, it was inevitable that the war was going to end. Why would they do that one? The Germans most certainly were not doing that. And therefore, it's fast and loose with the facts. And the film, sorry, the book and then the previous two versions of All Quiet, including the one with John Boy Walton in it, by the way, ends with him reaching out for a butterfly and being shot by a sniper. That kind of represents futility. The way that film ends with kind of him being stabbed and then bleeding to death, and then the war ends and everybody just wanders around, it's not good. And there were just so many things wrong with it. By the way, it's still better than Napoleon, but I know we're not talking about Napoleon.
All right. Do you want to share some of your experiences advising filmmakers and helping with sets and things like that?
People work in different ways. Sam Mendes was very much a question at the beginning of the day, a question at lunchtime, a question at the end of the day. That was the way he worked. I was very much behind the camera. Back in 2011, when we made War Horse, I was younger. And that meant that actually Steven Spielberg, eventually, when I was being called forward to go and speak to him, you know, wearing my modern clothes, black North Face, eventually said, this isn't working. And I thought I'd lost my job. I hadn't. He wanted me in uniform in the trench to be able to direct everything that was going on. And there was a moment when he said to me, well, you know, can the men mount up? And I said, no, because they can't mount down. The order is prepare to mount. There's a pause in between because the men know what they're going to do. And that's what Benedict Cumberbatch does. Later on, he tried to kind of beat me to it. And when they did the bayonet fixing sequence, he had the man giving the order to fix bayonets come down the trench and say, fix bayonets. And it was terrible. And he said, well, what's wrong? And I said, well, so, you know, without being funny, we have done this before. Preparative, prepare to fix bayonets. And everybody fixes on the B of bayonets. And he went, that's much better. And I said, well, yeah, because people wrote a drill book, so people knew how to do it. And he actually said to me, it's not rocket science, is it? I said, no, but it's knowing what's in the book of rocket science so you can do it properly. And that worked out very well. But I've worked on other movies where I probably had two questions in 5 or 6 days because they've already decided what they want to have on screen. You're there as the consultants. If they don't consult you, there's nothing you can do. There's no point basically, you know, spitting your dummy out and stamping your feet because they're going to carry on anyway. All you can do is give the best to say, look, we can improve this. I worked on a film recently where I knew the director hated to be given advice. So I sent advice through an assistant director and I was told I was finished for the day, which was great because it was driving me up the wall, you know, and that was knowing enough to be able to get fired, basically. Well, I didn't get fired. I still got paid. But I knew he wouldn't want me around because I was basically, I was marking his homework and he'd already written his own mark scheme.
So we're both historians and You mentioned Napoleon. I didn't. Yeah. But movies don't always give the public the most accurate presentation of a historical event. And obviously, movies are made for entertainment. But are historical dramas a net positive or a net negative for the wider study of history? And what do you think is the best way for historians to work with the film industry?
I think that the thing would be anybody out there that's keen on steam locomotives would watch a film like Anna Karenina and go, oh my God, those are not Russian broad gauge railways. It's ruined it for me. Well, sorry, everybody else have no idea what you're talking about. So basically, back in the box, just calm down. It doesn't matter that much to most people. What I think is misleading is when there are gross historical errors that creep into a film. And what you have to try and do is negotiate your way around it, knowing that you may be ignored. And every time I've been to a cast and crew preview, I have been terrified that some massive error would be in there and I would get blamed. As it was, I did get blamed about something, and I was very pleased. That was, I had a number of people in the film 1917 that were non-white, representing the mixture of people in the British Army, and an actor and politician decided I was wrong. So I was happy to take that on the chin and go, no, I'm the one that's correct. You're the one that's wrong. You want it to be a white army. It wasn't. So, you know, that was a way of subverting. And by the way, the reason I did that was, A, it was historically accurate. And also Sam Mendes's grandfather, Alfred Mendes, was half Trinidadian and half Portuguese. So he was not a white soldier, you know, therefore not having, you know, a character, you know, in the film that isn't white would be misleading. You know, the majority were, but some were not. And that's what we saw on the screen.
Any other final thoughts?
Final thoughts. Basically, I love the process of making the films. I do. And if anybody wants advice on any movie, please let me know. I've been basically breaking my teeth on some Second World War films. I worked on Mincemeat with Colin Firth and thoroughly loved it. I have to say that at times it's incredibly boring. It's a very long process. It's not exciting. And I took my daughter to see the making of War Horse. And I asked her afterwards what she thought as a young teenager of Steven Spielberg. And she said, bossy. I then introduced her to Peter Jackson, who made the Lord of the Rings series, but then made They Shall Not Grow Old. I had a pub lunch with him. You know, what did you think of Peter Jackson? And now, much older, she said, scruffy. So I've never introduced her to any of film directors because I have no idea what she's going to say. But I think, you know, as an outsider looking in, it's a very strange world. But it can illuminate our understandings of the Great War in a way that other media cannot. It is, after all, the Great War as imagined, not experienced. That's my takeaway line.
That's key. Well, thank you so much for joining us yet again on the World War I podcast. And we look forward to talking to you more in the future.
Fine. Just before we finish, can I say that I'm currently running a replica trench system here in the UK. We're teaching hundreds of young people about the experience. But the experience that we talk about is my 99%. This is cold, wet, bored soldiers. We don't deal with combat because that wouldn't be A, ethical, or B, realistic.
Sounds like a great project.
It is.
Well, thanks again for joining us. And like I said, we will look forward to talking to you more in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you have questions, suggestions, or comments, we want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at MacArthur1880, on Facebook as the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial, or you can email MacArthurMemorial@norfolk.gov.